8 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, WEAF, New York. The temperature in Manhattan this morning is 71 degrees.
Good morning, everyone. Another Monday morning, and the war abroad has spread to another front. NBC representatives covering it firsthand, the news in foreign capitals, are ready to give it to you direct, only minutes old. And now the news from England. Go ahead, London.
This is John McVane in London. In two coordinated thrusts, British and Russian troops this morning crossed the border of Iran to stamp out the nest of Nazi agents that have been a constant threat to the Allied position in the Middle East. Authoritative quarters in London reveal that the Russians are striking down from the narrow Caucasus Peninsula, where the Iranian border approaches the important Russian oil fields and the pipeline that connects the Black Sea with the Caspian. British troops are moving into the southern part of Iran, but no details are available here of the exact areas. There's no indication so far in London as to whether or not the Iranians are resisting. General Wavell, the British commander in India, is said to be in charge of the operations, but authoritative quarters here won't say whether this means that he's controlling the Russians as well as the British Imperial forces. There's also no means of telling here whether the Royal Navy in the Persian Gulf is cooperating with the armies. Most observers here believe the Navy has been operating in the Gulf, but the Gulf is not only one of Russia's chief lifelines at the moment, but the reinforcement of the British troops in Iran was carried out by landings at the head of the Gulf. The neighboring countries of Iraq, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia have been informed by the British of the action against Iran, and the reasons have been made clear. The move is generally taken here as a necessary precaution to guard Russia's Achilles heel, the Caucasus oil fields, and to make sure the German fifth columnists don't endanger the Iran and Iraq oil fields. Without the oil from these fields, the British Middle Eastern Army and the Mediterranean Fleet would be in a very difficult position. Sudden destruction of the fields by German agents or a small German force would leave the Middle Eastern forces temporarily in great difficulty. The Shah of Iran was given what is regarded as a very fair chance to make his position clear. Iran had always played off Britain against Russia. And when the Anglo-Russian Pact put an end to that policy, Iran attempted to balance Germany against both Russia and Britain. In times of peace, Iran might have succeeded, but to the British and Russians at war, the Iranian government's tortuous scheming seemed a direct threat against their own immediate safety. The British Foreign Office, in a long statement issued this morning, disclosed that Iran had been repeatedly warned during the past month of the danger of fostering a large German colony subject to Nazi Party orders. As the Foreign Office explains it, German agents have infiltrated into and replaced the resident German community in Iran. German technical experts and agents were employed in Iranian factories, public works, roads, railroads, and many other posts. The Foreign Office said there can be no doubt that as in other neutral countries, the German resident community would be employed, whenever it seemed to the German government the appropriate moment had arrived, to create disorders with a view to assist the execution of Germany's military plan. About the middle of July, it said, the British, realizing that all their arguments hadn't had any effect with the Iranians, started putting on the diplomatic screws. The British told Iran that getting rid of the Germans was a matter of the utmost gravity and urgency. The German invasion of Russia, as it's explained, made the whole matter a problem that had to be settled at once, and the Russian ambassador in Iran made the same demand at the same time. India is concerned in the matter since Iran is a neighbor, and Iraq is involved because German agents had started the unsuccessful revolt in Iraq. The revolt that, had it been better time, might have been a dress rehearsal for a similar outbreak against the British in Iran. The Iranians, faced with this combined Anglo-Russian demand, seem to have tried a compromise. They admitted, in principle, the wisdom of the advice given to them, but apparently fearing the Germans, they only sent a handful of the total number out of the country. Britain and Russia on August 16th repeated their demand in what's called the most formal and emphatic manner, saying the German community must be expelled from Iran. The British and the Russians told Iran they were all in favor of Iranian neutrality, and they had no designs against Iran's political independence or territorial integrity. They seemed to have made it very clear, however, that they didn't intend to put up with any chance of a stab in the back by German fifth columnists. The Allies said that a few of the most important Germans could be retained temporarily on specially important work. As for the rest, the Britons and Russians would find technical experts to replace those who held technical jobs. And if there were any temporary hardship caused by the departure of many trained men, the Allies would take steps to see Iran wouldn't suffer. The British don't seem to have minced any words in warning the Iranians. It's learned authoritatively here that the British ambassador, before the attack, told the Iran government that London felt Iran had displayed deliberate blindness in the whole issue, and that the Iranian replies were unsatisfactory. The attitude of the men in the street here toward the new move is one of approval. It's a way to help Russia, and that's something just about everyone here wants. The woman who sells me my papers said today, "Good news, isn't it? It may end the war just that much sooner." And this is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
Before we switch back again to Europe, here are the latest dispatches from Nazi Germany. Berlin. The Germans say two Nazi armies are crashing Marshal Timoshenko's troops between Gomel and Kiev. Apparently, the two armies are grinding the Soviet army in a giant encircling movement. If this proves successful, the roads to Kiev and Moscow will be opened. The Germans make no mention of their drive on Leningrad, but Berlin says the siege of Odessa continues without respite. And another city is said to be surrounded by German forces. It's Tallinn in the northern Baltic state of Estonia. Berlin claims that rear communications to this city have been cut off. And now for our next direct broadcast, this time from Moscow, Russia.
We turn the microphone over to Robert Magidov.
Hello, NBC. This is Robert Magidov speaking from Moscow. The Red Army has entered Iran. Simultaneously, British troops crossed the Iranian frontier from the south. This first joint action of Soviet Russia and Great Britain nipped in the bud any chance of seizure by the Germans of control of Iran, whose geographic position and natural resources make that country so desirable in the eyes of Hitler. The official Russian announcement of this joint action has made it clear that the Soviet Union has absolutely no designs on Iran's political independence or territorial integrity. Monsieur Molotov, in the note which he handed to the short, gray-haired, Russian-speaking Iranian ambassador Mohammed Said, said that as soon as the German danger to Iran will have disappeared to the satisfaction of the Soviet government, the Red Army troops will be withdrawn. This action has taken place after three warnings by the Kremlin to the government of Iran have drawn the attention of Tehran on the subversive and widespread activities of German agents in this vital Near Eastern country, so close to the Soviet Baku oil base that the control of Iran by any hostile power is a direct threat and immediate danger to Russia's war potential. This action has not been unexpected by foreign observers in Moscow, but it has been engineered with the utmost secrecy and efficiency so that neither the time nor the exact form of action was preconceived by the most informed persons in the Soviet capital. The joint Soviet-British action will work for still closer ties between the USSR and Great Britain. Churchill's speech yesterday promising to stand by Russia has been received with unmistakable satisfaction here, which is the greater because the Russians realize that behind these assurances made after Churchill's conference with President Roosevelt stands that great arsenal of democracy, the United States of America. The epic battle along the entire 2,000-mile Eastern Front has been raging in the meantime with unabated fury. Especially hard fighting is taking place on the approaches to Leningrad, where the Germans are hammering away with apparently little result from the south and from the north. The latest Russian communique issued a short time ago said again that fierce fighting is going on in the directions of the ancient city of Novgorod in the south and Kexholm, situated in the northeastern corner of the heavily fortified Karelian Isthmus. Despite the heaviest German losses, the Reichswehr is stubbornly pursuing its drive in the hope of capturing the city before the heavy cold rains, followed by snow and frost, will help the Red Army chill the Nazi fighting spirit to despair. As a matter of fact, the first autumn rains have already begun their work in alliance with the Red Army, People's Detachments, and guerrillas in the Leningrad district. First reports of guerrilla activity in the occupied areas of the Leningrad district indicate that the German supplies and communications there are in an even greater danger than in any other German-occupied Soviet region, because the entire Leningrad district is to a great extent an industrial area with age-old traditions of organization and collective effort. Thousands of workers and peasants, it is officially stated, have already begun their destructive work on the German rear. The usual German methods of terror are of no avail. When the Nazis spray several dozen Russians to guard telephone wires, making them responsible for these wires, the would-be guards destroy the entire line and join guerrillas. I now return you to the NBC in New York.
And that's the latest news of the war. We've heard those direct reports from foreign capitals. Next, we'll have the news direct from our own capital. We take you now to Earl Godwin, speaking from the NBC newsroom in Washington.
And good morning to you. There's plenty of small routine news in Washington this morning, but the main subject is Prime Minister Winston Churchill's remarks yesterday. Washington is studying them. Studying them, you will find that when the isolationists in Congress get through studying them and get the fires lighted and the bellows working, there will be considerable heat and anger over portions of the British Prime Minister's speech, which isolationists claim will give the British Empire the idea that the United States has been sewed up in a sack and delivered to Britain in a shooting war. Of course, you must remember that any time foreign relations are mentioned, Washington divides pro-administration versus isolationists. The great surprise here in Washington was the way that Mr. Churchill backed up the United States in our strained relations with Japan. Here in Washington, up to that speech, at least, the accepted version had been that our State Department has been backing up Great Britain. We awake this morning to find that Britain thinks, or the Prime Minister says, that Britain is backing up this country. Mr. Churchill mentioned his own Singapore and the Philippine Islands, which are our wards, as the two danger spots in the far eastern Pacific, which will be permitted and admitted by experts. Rumblings from some of our isolationists indicate that they will attack that attitude on the part of Mr. Churchill, but on the other hand, Senator Capper of Kansas, who generally lines up with the isolationists, says that Mr. Churchill gave Japan a lot of good advice. Prime Minister Churchill evidently believes this country is really in for a troublesome time with Japan, while on the other hand, about the last thing that occurred in the State Department Saturday night was a long and really heartfelt confab between the Japanese ambassador and the Secretary of State, Mr. Hull, in which the ambassador said there must be some way of easing the relations between his people and the American people. That may be a personal gesture on the Japanese ambassador's part, because I think that he is sincerely, deeply, and truly engrossed in trying to straighten out the mess. But of course, he cannot promise that his militaristic government will quit those tactics which have brought about the strained relations as far as we're concerned. Another thing that puzzles Washington today is the, you might call it the high hat attitude reported to have been adopted by Russian Premier Stalin, who, our experts tell me, has let it be known that if the United States sends a mission to Russia, along with the British war mission, that he wants no second string men from the United States. He wants at least men of cabinet rank. We also learn from officials who have to keep silent in public that American Army observers in Russia on diplomatic mission have not been permitted to observe the Russian Army at the front at all and are followed by spies from hour to hour. These and other evidences of communistic disdain for capitalistic United States of America are making it difficult for those here who have the cooperating job to do. The gas situation troubles. The American Automobile Association is all heated up and is on its hind legs this morning asking Congress to clear up the foggy gas curfew situation which they say exists all through the East. Latest word from Deputy Oil Chief Davies was a plan to deliver so-called September quota early enough so that Labor Day motorists could joyride and tour to their heart's content and pay for it later with less gas or no gas. The AAA charges that motorists have been humbugged with conflicting statements. Well, all I can say for the oil boss, Deputy Oil Boss Davies, is that all he asked for was a 10% reduction and has asked for no more. And that's all from Washington at this time.
And with the news from our own capital, we conclude this morning roundup of news in Europe and America. This news is presented at the same time every morning and is heard over most of these stations Monday through Saturday. This is the National Broadcasting Company.